session number 16850, reel 6.
Mr. Gibson, reel 6.
This is on the MSR, and we just suffered an air attack from the Americans. It was definitely American planes, because I looked up and I seen these little short clip wing planes with the American stars on them, and that's how bright it was. And hearing people say, don't look up, your face will shine white and they'll see where you are. But they'd already spotted where we were anyhow. But anyhow, they must have just given it a sort of perfunctory blast of gunfire, a couple of passes with the plane underneath the lights. He ripped up the road quite a bit, killed a pig. I remember him killing a pig that was off the side near a farm. The pig got the machine gun in the stockade that it was kept in, because we were pretty close to habitation at the time, with the city burning off in the distance. So we carried on after the lights had gone out, and 10 minutes after everything had gone quiet, the order came along from the Chinese guards, a few boots and a few bumps with the rifle butt, up you get, we're on the move again. So we carried on marching, and that's the way it proceeded. March during the night, all night, and just before dawn they headed off either into the hills or near a habitation, or at the very least we ended up in a grove of stunted Korean pine and had to stay undercover during the daytime. But I think these were planned stops. They knew that they would march you all night, and they knew where you'd be by dawn the following morning. And I think the trackers who'd gone forward and laid the trail had already set up a working kitchen of rice, I think, had cooked up the rice, and you got your rice ball. As soon as they got you undercover, you were given your rice ball and your tin of water. Now, if you happen to have a large tin, you had a large tin of water. If you happen to have a bean tin size, small bean tin, then you've got a bean tin size of water. So it was in your interest to get as big a container as you could for the water. Tobacco, you didn't have. Medical attention, you didn't have. A lot of bad feet, sore feet, boots fell to pieces at a very early stage. The Korean issue boots, ski boot type, were absolutely useless. They literally fell to pieces. I think they must have been 50 years old when we got them. Too long in storage, you know, in an army store. And then they'd been dug out for the Korean issue. And you slept most of the day, started off again in the evening. It was towards the end of, as I said before, May, late May, beginning of June, when we finally came into a Korean village. And we came into the Korean village at, funny enough, dusk. Now, we'd stopped in one farm. It looked like a deserted farmhouse, but there was actually people living in the farm, Koreans, North Koreans, and I remember with me and a young chap who I remember came from Jersey, because we called him Jersey Tom after the Jersey tomato, and I said to him, do you think if we sneaked away in the dark we could find something to eat, or smoke is what we were really looking for, the Korean tobacco leaf. They hung them up in bunches from their rafters in their barns, raw tobacco leaf to cure. So we went off crawling through and crawled into the cattle barn where they kept their cattle. One cow, I think it was, in there. But we didn't find any tobacco, but we found like a bean curd cake, very mouldy, green, and we ate it. We broke it up. It's actually stuff that they fed their cows as a winter feed, and it looked like husks and soybean all squashed into a, like a cheese size slab, round. And I think they fed it to their cattle, but we ate it. I mean, it didn't help my dysentery any, and it didn't cure it either, you know. But when we started out that following night, as I said, round about dusk, we hadn't marched far, and we were in a village. And I thought, well, this is queer, because they don't bring us through villages. I thought, well, I wonder if they're going to, because we'd heard tales that they paraded in through certain people through Pyongyang. And though when we did pass any North Koreans, the Chinese, and they started hurling abuse in their way at us and spitting at us, the Chinese just laughed and let them do it, but wouldn't let them touch us. They wouldn't let them near us. They let them shout all sorts of things in Korean, which we didn't understand, but their attitude was made it quite clear what they were saying. Or they would spit at us or try to throw stones, but the Chinese put a stop to it. They let them shout and jeer and spit, but not touch or not throw anything. So they did look after us in that respect. But when we got into this village, I thought, oh, I wonder if they're going to parade us through the village. That thought went through my mind. But apparently that was our POW camp. We'd actually reached it. We didn't realise it, but they'd taken over most of a Korean village on the banks of a river. It had already been cleared, and it had already been designated as a POW camp. In other words, the road ran straight through the village. They had a barbed wire barrier at the one end of the village and a barbed wire barrier at the other end. And in the hills to the both sides of the village, they had guards on platforms, or just sat up in the hills overlooking the village. But we didn't know it at the time, but that was our final resting place. And when we were expecting to carry on marching, because we'd only been marching about an hour, and then the interpreters come in, this, you sit down, you stay here. Yeah? And we thought, oh, there must be something going on, we're not going to march for the rest of the night. We got so used to marching that we fully expected that we were going to complete another night's march. But apparently the idea was that we stayed there, and then in the dawn of the following morning, we just laid down where we could. They started the detail of different numbers of people to different, like, mud huts, the villagers' quarters, what used to be the village huts. And well, I don't know if you've ever seen a Korean house. It's a pretty simple affair. It's a built-up foundation with pine trees, logs on each corner, and a thatched roof and mud walls, wattle and mud. Inside, it's just a bare rectangle with baked mud floor. And the reason it was baked, because underneath the floor at one end was an oven that you could light a fire, and the flames would race through underneath the house down different channels and out of a chimney at the other end, and that was their heating during the winter. They would burn stuff in there, the wind would blow it through, the heat would rise up through the floor, and excess smoke would go out through the chimney. So you had underfloor heating, and that, of course, baked the floor solid, hard baked floor, very dusty. But they put like rush mats down, that like fine bamboo mat on top of it. So we were detailed at 20 men to one of these rooms, 20 men to a room, 20 men, and then you went along like a row of little houses, 20 men in each, 20 men in that, 20 men in there. The bigger rooms, of course, they got more, but the smaller rooms, never less than 20. So we end up arranging ourselves again, 10 down each side, head to the wall, feet to the centre. It was a bit of a crush. And we had a lie like that on these rush mats, no blankets, in what was left of our uniforms. I mean, most of us were emaciated then anyhow, so it was very painful lying on a hip bone which was protruding, and it caused a lot of sores on the hips, lying with no bedding. And that first day there, we were tallied off as 20 men to a thing. Then they set up a kitchen in, it looked like a communal bakehouse. It was just, again, another mud hut with three huge iron, black cast iron rice pots set into a mud range with a fire that you pushed in sticks and wood and straw underneath and heated it up. And they cooked rice. Rice was more like watery, very gross. Actually, it was crawling with worms. It was what they call worm-infested rice. That we honestly thought that it was stuff they wouldn't give their own troops, and they would just give it to the POWs, cut down the costs. But we had our diet consisted of rice some days, sorghum some days, and millet some days interspaced. There was nothing else. It was rice, sorghum, or millet. And the rice was at first a very watery gruel with millions of these little white worms floating on top. They were worms because we see they were worms, like grubs. And it was very watery, more like wallpaper paste than anything else. But you got a tin of that in the morning and a tin in the evening. Again, it depended on the size of your tin. But they put British troops in our section in charge of the cookhouse, people that who said they could cook. But all they could cook was rice. So it was a matter of putting in flames, heating the water, pouring the bag of rice that the Chinese quartermaster gave them in. It's full of weevils and things. It was actually old stock that they must have been stockpiled, and rather than dish it out to their frontline troops or their, give it to the prisoners. They had the better rice, because I never ever saw theirs when the guards were eating. They didn't have that sort of rice. Theirs was white fluffy rice, as you would expect that you'd normally get. And ours was like a watery grey gruel with thousands. But the medical people who were with us, the first aiders and stuff like that, said, eat them because they're protein. You know, just close your eyes and eat it. And they're dead and it's protein. So we just ate it. Sorghum, I hated. The sorghum was a nasty food. It was made up the same way, like a gruel, and it had an awful taste to it, but you ate it because that was all there was. And the millet, that was the same. It was not very pleasant stuff to eat, but it was like millet seed boiled into a gruel, and you got a tin full of that. So it was good. Later, I mean, they brought in the 31st winter. I mean, remember, we were June, July, August, and then we were back into September, October, with the very hot months. Had already we were actually in the camp in the first year. No medical aid, as I said. Very poor food. A lot of deaths. People dying from dysentery. People dying from beriberi, just swelling up and malnutrition. A lot of Americans died, and there was burial parties every day. They designated a part of the hills for a burial party, and there was one hut which they we termed the death hut, where if you were very bad and you were on your last legs, more or less, the people in your hut would move you to it. It was supposed to be a hospital hut, but in actual fact it was a death house, because there was no hospital stuff. They just laid you in there in the semi-darkness, and you just died. And every day the Chinese would go in and bring a detail of prisoners in and tell them, take this one out, take that one out, take that one out, wrap them in a blanket and on an old stretcher, put them on a stretcher and carry them up into the hills. And the ground was so rocky that the people detailed to go and dig the graves where they were exhausted and full of malnutrition and could hardly dig a grave. You know, most they got through the rocky ground was about 4 or 5 inches, just a scrape, and they put the body in and throw the stuff that they dug out on top of it. Of course, next day they went up with the next consignment of dead, and they found that the dogs had dug out the bodies, and there was bits of bodies everywhere. They'd literally, the what used to be the village dogs, which had gone wild and were living wild around, had gone and dug out the bodies, you see. And it, of course, you couldn't tell the Chinese anything about it, they wouldn't listen. And I was put in there with bad dysentery, and I begged the people in my hut, you know, I didn't want to go. I said, if I get so bad with dysentery and that I can't no longer stand, I said, just don't put me in that place, because once you go in there, you only come out one way. You come out in a blanket and onto a stretcher. I said, leave me outside at the end of the hut near the stove entrance, where they put the flame, the fireplace they called it. I said, just leave me there, and then they can dispose of me if I. But they took me actually out and put me in that hut, and I didn't. I crawled back out. I was so bad with dysentery that I could count my backbone literally through the front. I could actually feel the knobbles of my backbone by pressing my hands into my stomach, and the pains of dysentery is terrible, very wretched and sick. And yeah, we had a detail, we set up the camp. It took a good few months before we got it fully organized, and by that time the Chinese had divided the camp up into different areas. One area they separated all the American prisoners. Another area they separated Filipinos. Another area they Norwegians or whoever, all United Nations people, and British. We had our area, and I must admit that out of all the areas, the British was the best of the lot, because we were able to organise better. We were not used to be a mollycoddle in the field. You know, there's what there is, make the best of it. And the typical British, they do make the best of it. I must admit, we had not as many deaths as the Americans' camp, or the American sector of the camp, and they had the most. They literally, Americans, very tall, 6'6", 6 foot, 6 foot 2, they suddenly looked like walking skeletons, and they just collapsed down in a heap, and just, that was it. They'd still be alive, and their own friends would walk past them, their own kind would walk past them. And when you say, well, why don't you see to him? Oh, he's going to die. He'd give up. He doesn't want to live. He wants to go home. He can't go home, so he's going to die. And that's how they did. And I don't want to take anything that Americans fought well, but when it come to the stage where privation and all sorts of things were happening, they weren't very well equipped to deal with it. I think the British were very well equipped for some reason. They were well disciplined, always good discipline. And remember, we had our NCOs all separated from us. They'd gone. Our officers had all gone. It was just the enlisted regulars and quite a few, I must say this with regret, national servicemen, right? From different units, mostly Gloucesters, some from our own units, some from the Northumberlands, different units, Tank Corps, Hussars. But we formed ourselves into a unit. We even set up a sports field of our own, where we could kick an old bag around stuffed with rags and stitched up piece of army trouser leg with cloth as a football, whereas the Americans just lay around dying. They just didn't want to do nothing. They didn't want to organize. it's difficult because there was one I did remember. He was very, very nice. I've got his name in my book, actually. I met, who carried his friend around. His friend had both his legs amputated at just above the knee, and he carried him around on his back like a monkey. Now, wherever he went, that GI went with him. And when he took him down to the river, which we were allowed to walk to the banks of the river, which was ran more or less right through the camp, and wash in the river. It was a stony river with water running through it. I think it was a tributary of the Yalu, or it ran to the Yalu, because we weren't far from the Yalu River at that time. And we used to wash in there. We could drink from it, again at risk. But he used to take this GI down to the river and bathe him. And he looked after him. But eventually, the chap took him to the amputation, because he'd had his legs amputated by a Korean doctor in a hospital, apparently, in Pyongyang, in a field hospital just in Pyongyang. So and then he finally been told that, like, they brought him to join the camp. He joined the camp. He did succumb because of infection, I think, to his legs. But that's the sort of thing that sticks out in your mind, the bad food. And we improved our lot. They set up the Chinese set up a little office in one of the little houses. It's called the interpreter's office. Now, every section, American, Filipino, whoever, their section had an interpreter's office who spoke their language. So we had a one who spoke English, same as the Americans had one that spoke English but had been educated in America. And we had one who spoke English but had been educated in India, or educated in Peking, or at one of the universities, and it was taken English language. These were interpreters. They were fully dressed as Chinese, in the Chinese uniform, Chinese crinkle cap with a red star. They carried a sand brown belt around their waist with the usual Mauser, which signified, of course, they were officer class in that hierarchy. They weren't just an ordinary soldier. They were interpreters, and they interpreted everything for us. I mean, every morning we had a parade while we were counted, and then of course we had the usual political harangue from the camp commandant. Right, he would tell us in no uncertain terms what we were, what he thought of us. We were capitalist lackeys, imperial lackeys, capitalist pigs. We were only there to take the Korean people's lives, and the usual stuff. It's too numerous to come out with, the stuff that they come out with. And we should all recant. We should all confess to our sins. And this became a very more and more pronounced as they went into their studies. We all became, instead of POWs, we suddenly became students. You are now students, and we are going to politicize you, politically educate you. This was their first harangue. You'll be issued with the material for you to study. And of course it did. The thoughts of Mao. We all had to sit in groups. They formed us into groups of five or six, and a study leader, and the study leader had to be responsible for the other five. You had to read the thoughts of Mao, Kim Il-sung's address from Kim Il-sung. You had to read all the latest China News Agency stuff, which of course I showed you them little clips that thing, how the people in London, the poor were being oppressed and living in poverty, and you are fighting the war of the imperialists, and the imperialists are going to take. Of course, it was like water off a duck's back. The British troop, very few of us took any of it on board. Now, whether that spoke for the fact that we were rather dim-witted, I don't know. But we laughed it. And, of course, the more we laughed, the more infuriated the interpreters became, because they were being held responsible to the camp commandant. And, of course, they took it out on us, because we wouldn't learn. We wouldn't confess our sins. Actually, it got to a point where, for the most minor thing, transgression, and I had this, you were made to confess. You had to write it down, your confessions. Now, they never told you what to confess, but confess your crimes was the thing that came through. And you had to think to yourself, well, what crime? So you invented crimes to confess to. You soon clicked onto the fact that what they wanted you to say was, I confess to being a lackey of the imperialists. I have done their command and bidding to the working class people of the world. I have oppressed the working class, and all this sort of stuff. This is what they really wanted to hear, whether it was true or not. Which was the biggest laugh, because I, at one point, I'd been hit with shrapnel, as I said earlier, just before capture, and I put my hands up in front of my face, and I received a chunk in my here, in my hand, you see that part there. So one of the Chinese